loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriagou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, in recent days, Bitcoin has surged, crashed, and surged again as the cryptocurrency becomes one of the most talked about subjects in economics. Today, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange was given regulatory approval to even begin selling futures of the once fringe project. Next, the U.S. Department of Commerce has taken the rare step of beginning an anti-dumping investigation directed at China, not because of a complaint brought by a corporation or a trade group, but on their own initiative. Then, activist and author Miko Peled joins us to talk about his new book, Injustice, the story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. And then, the European Union and the United Kingdom have reportedly finally reached an agreement on the size of the so-called divorce bill as part of negotiations over the exit of the country from the European Union. Is Brexit back on track, or is the hard part just beginning? And finally, Americans continue to be gobsmacked at the pace of sexual harassment allegations coming out of Washington, Hollywood, the media, and now even tech companies. Meanwhile, the New York Times is keeping a count of how many men are being accused of crimes ranging from sexual misconduct to sending lewd texts to rape. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Bitcoin. In recent days, Bitcoin has surged, crashed, and surged again as the cryptocurrency becomes one of the most talked about subjects in economics. Today, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange was given regulatory approval to even begin selling futures of the once fringe project. We're joined from Amsterdam by Steve Keen. He is the author of Debunking Economics and the World's First Crowdfunded Economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. Steve, thanks again for joining us.
Glad to be here, Matt.
Steve, does this indicate really the mainstreaming of Bitcoin? We've been hearing about futures and the idea of establishing futures. We've been hearing about Bitcoin-related mutual funds and hedge funds buying Bitcoin. Is this really putting Bitcoin in the mainstream?
I think it is, but I'm still not sure that it's in the mainstream at a price it can sustain indefinitely, because a large reason why it's attracted attention, of course, is the pretty much, virtually tenfold increase in the price in the last year and virtually doubling in the last month, and that's what's attracting attention. Now, that's much more, you've got to ask yourself Ponzi questions when you start seeing those rates of increase.
Well, we've been seeing comparisons, really, to the Dutch tulip debacle of the 17th century, aren't we? Where tulip prices ended up being higher than the prices of the land that the tulips were.
I think one tulip bulb was worth 12 acres.
Exactly. It's crazy. Even the Wall Street Journal yesterday had a front page chart that was just so ridiculous, comparing Bitcoin over the past year with the periods of greatest and quickest gain for things like the Japanese yen or housing prices or even tech stocks. And there is literally no comparison whatsoever. No legitimate investment has ever increased in value so dramatically and so quickly like Bitcoin has, which, you know, tells me, and I think tells many people, that this just isn't sustainable. Would you agree?
Yeah. And that's partly my point, because unlike tulips, there is a use for Bitcoin. I think it will be used for transactions. The question is, can it be used for transactions at the price it's currently selling for? And does the infrastructure behind Bitcoin enable transactions to actually be made at anything like a realistic basis for a capitalist economy? And at the moment, I'm not sure the answer to either of those questions is yes. And they need to be yes to sustain this price rise.
Steve, one of the Bitcoin chat rooms or chat sites that I subscribe to says that many people are starting to hoard Bitcoin because not just because of this crazy increase in value, but because if you use Bitcoin to, let's say, download an album or buy a pizza, it's going to be worth more, 10%, 20% more an hour later than it is when you make the purchase. So why bother purchasing it? It's better to hoard it. But isn't that really antithetical to what Bitcoin is supposed to be all about?
Yeah, this is you can't use as currency anything which is hyper deflationary like Bitcoin, because any use of it is, by definition, a sign of your own insanity, because looking at the price of Bitcoin roughly a year ago, 1,000 Bitcoin would have bought a fairly nice three-bedroom house on the outskirts of Silicon Valley. Now that same amount of Bitcoin would buy a nice mansion in the middle of Silicon Valley, a factor of 10 increase in what you could purchase in 1 year. So at that level, transactions themselves are made ludicrous by Bitcoin's own increase in price, unless those transactions are caught up with Bitcoin's growth itself. So a large part of where the transactions actually are coming from right now are people are buying these mining rigs, specialized computer hardware to generate the nonce sequences that are part of verifying a block of transactions on Bitcoin. And they make a, they buy them for, you know, $15,000, they make a profit of four times that over a year, and then they have to buy the next upgrade because the energy consumption and the processing speed needs continue increasing. So all the Bitcoin purchases that are taking place right now are all related to being caught in the Bitcoin space and continuing to mine Bitcoins.
Steve, let me ask you, what's the governing structure of Bitcoin since there's no state backing this as a currency?
This is the interesting thing, because normally for the standard reality of a banking transaction, there are one person selling a commodity, another person buying it, and a bank then acts as the what's called trusted third party. Of course, you've got to act trusted in inverted commas when you talk about banks these days, that actually transfers by its liabilities from one account to another to enable that transaction to occur. And there's, of course, back offices behind the banks that make sure the transaction being made is actually being done by the person who owns the credit card or owns the bank account and so on. And what Bitcoin instead does is distribute this ledger that used to, is normally proprietary to banks and maintained by banks as a centralized institution, becomes a ledger which is distributed across hundreds and thousands of computers. And they're, what they're doing in terms of mining is competing to be the ones who verify a particular transaction. But the model on which Bitcoin was based was seeing money as ideally being gold. And one of my major points for many years has been gold has never been money. Money has always been based on trust, not based on a commodity. This tried to ape a commodity by meaning it, you had to use a large amount of energy to mine the Bitcoin in the same way you need energy to mine gold. And as more and more of the Bitcoin that exists is being discovered, then it gets harder and harder to find the remaining Bitcoin, again, on an analogy to gold. But the result of this is the transactions, because they have to be verified by hundreds and thousands of computers around the world, the time element of 10 minutes to verify a block and to win the next reward of more Bitcoin, and the processing power and the network distribution of data around the global network is becoming absolutely enormous. And that's what I see as being just unsustainable. Apparently, at the current price, not only are people who are mining Bitcoin making, you know, four times their money in a year, at the same time, the amount of energy they're consuming is equivalent to the energy consumption of Ireland. Now, that's when it's only handling a trivial number of transactions, the order of thousands of transactions a month, maybe even less than that, versus billions of transactions, which are commonplace in capitalism. To scale it up from the thousands to the billions may not even be possible. And that is, I think, the what could be the tulip point for this increase in price.
Steve Keen, we have about 3 minutes left. Let me just ask you, in 2007, 2008, the U.S. had a major financial meltdown. The major banks were about to go down. They were going down. Some of them never came back. But the government, you know, drew a circle. The Federal Reserve and the Treasury drew a circle around some banks, some mega banks, and said, you are too big to fail. And then began a policy of quantitative easing, whereby the government and the Federal Reserve, having the ability to print its own money, having that luxury, was able to just print trillions of dollars in what was called quantitative easing and just giving that money to the banks and allowing the banks to do with that money what they wanted to do, no strings attached. That would indicate a certain arbitrariness on the part of states when it comes to currency, too. I mean, is there a fundamental difference in terms of the arbitrary capacities of a state with, say, the Bitcoin governance?
No, I think, in fact, you might say you've got two flawed systems competing for dominance of the monetary system right now, because the motivation for the inventor of Bitcoin was specifically the fact that banks were, first of all, the financial crisis with the banks collapsing, And then the reaction of the government being not to throw the bankers into jail for breaching both ethics and laws left, right, and center, but to rescue them with state-created money. And in fact, the very first Bitcoin ever mined by the creator of Bitcoin specifically included an excerpt about the Chancellor in the UK being about to launch a second bailout of the banking system. So it's all been done specifically with a political edge against this corrupt financial system we currently have. But I think it was based on a false analogy to gold as being what money should be. And given the technology, the huge consumption of energy that was built into the verification that meant you could have a trustless ledger rather than a centrally trusted ledger, this means you've got two competing false paradigms about the nature of money. Whether one can take over the other, I just don't believe that the transactional capability of Bitcoin is there to take over the transactional role that the current monetary system does very well, or it doesn't do well, of course, is get money to people who deserve it.
Very interesting. We have 30 seconds left. In full disclosure, John Kiriakou is a major investor in Bitcoin. He put $200 in there. He's become, well, not wealthy, but...
But I do brag about my returns just about every day.
Every day. Is it a good investment, Steve Keen?
It certainly is at the moment if you get out early enough. This is the trouble. If there is a bubble about to burst, then the thing you do is you sell before the bubble comes to its end. So people are making a large amount of money right now. Some people like Max Kaiser have gone from buying it at under three to having it at virtually 15,000. So they've made a factor of 5,000 increase in their money. But I think at some point there has to be a break in that trend if it's ever going to be sustainable for transactions.
John, you have a $400, you're up $400, maybe it's time to sell. Anyway,
yeah. We're Christmas season.
It's Christmas season,
yes.
Yeah. Those boots for your kids.
That's right.
We're out of time. We've been joined from Amsterdam by Steve Keen. He is the author of Debunking Economics. He's the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof Steve Keen. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We're going to be talking in this segment about U.S.-China trade relations. If you look, John Kiriakou, at the China Daily, the headline is Beijing vows to act over U.S. probe of dumping. We're going to talk about what's actually going on with David Ewing. He is the co-chair of the U.S.-China Friendship Association from San Francisco. Welcome back, David.
Nice to be back. Thank you.
David, the first paragraph of the China Daily story from 2 days ago is China will take necessary measures to ensure Chinese aluminum companies' legal rights, the Ministry of Commerce said on Wednesday, after the United States government launched its first self-initiated anti-dumping and countervailing duty case in 25 years. In other words, this charge by the U.S., against China for illegal dumping, meaning selling commodities below price because of government subsidy in the American market, came not from an aluminum company, but came from, or the Chamber of Commerce, it came from the U.S. government itself. Why would Donald Trump be escalating a trade war with China at the very moment that he says he's dependent on China to, quote, solve the North Korea problem? Go ahead.
President Trump has made so many contradictory promises concerning trade, building up the U.S. economy and so forth. You may recall that in 2016, during the campaign, he promised across-the-board 10% tariffs on all foreign trade. So it's a little, he's unpredictable, I think, in terms of what will his trade policy actually is. It's being formulated really, I think, on a political basis to perhaps please his base rather than on an economic basis. As you know, Brian, most economists oppose to these tariffs that are being offered now.
U.S.-China trade is organized along agreed-upon markers and international standards so that they apply whether it's a socialist economy or a state capitalist economy or a capitalist economy. What the American government is arguing, what the Trump administration is arguing, is that by that China's actually going against what it's agreed to in multilateral or bilateral trade agreements and giving additional subsidy to give a sort of an advantage for Chinese aluminum selling in the U.S. market. The U.S. has made the same claims in the past about steel and other basic core industrial commodities.
By solar panels, right. But I don't think that's true. And I think the Chinese are denying that there are illegal subsidies to the exports.
Brian, when I was growing up in Western Pennsylvania, many of the local steel manufacturers went through the same thing where, for example, there was one in my hometown called J&L Steel, and they made the only seamless tube in the world. It was revolutionary at the time. I'm talking about between, say, 1977 and 1982 or 83. The Japanese made seamed tube. It was of a lower quality, but it was cheaper. And on top of being cheaper, the Japanese government at the time was subsidizing it. And so the Japanese were able to dump it or to sell it in the United States at a price that was lower than the production cost of the seamless tube. The Commerce Department filed a complaint with the World Trade Organization, and all of a sudden there was no more seamed Japanese tube being dumped in the United States. I wonder if we're seeing the same situation here where the United States just can't compete on these issues like aluminum. We're talking today about aluminum. If the U.S. can't compete, if the U.S. can't sell aluminum at a price comparable to what the Chinese can sell it here in the United States, then the only alternatives are either lawsuits or sanctions.
Okay, we have about 3 minutes left. So, David, I want to jump on top of John Kiriakou's point and question and ask you this. The Trump administration has imposed new tariffs on Canada. It's reorganizing its trade with Mexico vis-a-vis a renegotiation of NAFTA. It says over time that the United States has gotten a bad deal in international trade. In the case of China exports a great deal to the United States. A lot of what it exports are actually from American companies and Western companies that are doing business in China. So it has a made in China label on it. And yet it's really the product of Western corporations. Under these circumstances, it would seem to me that even if the U.S. or even if China is dumping or selling below cost the aluminum, if the United States retaliates like this openly by the government, China can also retaliate, and that might lead to a trade war, which would ultimately have severe consequences for both countries, but it would seem to me particularly for U.S. industry.
The car producers have already come out against any tariffs, additional tariffs on steel, for example. In 2002, the old President Bush, George, he imposed 30% across the board steel tariffs. It really cost more than $200,000 job losses within the U.S., which is greater than all the people who were working in steel at the time in the U.S. So these kinds of trade restrictions and tariffs have a really an immediately bad impact on the U.S. economy, which is why manufacturing generally is opposed to these tariffs today.
But just for our audience to understand and for myself, why were those additional American jobs lost when Bush imposed the huge tariffs on China? What happened?
Because car producers and people who use steel had to pay a higher price for the raw product steel that they needed. So their profit rates went down, they laid off workers, and there was actually over 200,000 jobs were lost, which was greater than the entire steel industry. The idea was that Harris would help the steel industry by raising prices 30%, which it did. But it had an effect through the rest of the economy that uses the steel of raising the price of things. You raise the price of things, you sell fewer, you don't need as many workers. And that's what happened in 2002 in the U.S.
It's interesting because of the integration of economies. If the price of aluminum or steel goes up as a consequence of tariffs, other U.S. industrial producers, manufacturers, thus are purchasing steel or aluminum at a higher price. Okay, we're going to leave it right there. We've been speaking with David Ewing. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We are joined in studio by activist and author Mikko Peled. He is the author of a new book, Injustice, the story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. We're going to talk to him about this book. Welcome, Mikko.
Thank you. A pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. The Holy Land Foundation 5, who are they?
Five Palestinian Americans, Muslims, devout Muslims, who were involved with what used to be the largest Muslim charity in America, the Holy Land Foundation. And they were closed down by executive order by George Bush after 9/11. And this was after about a decade of it within which a lot has been done to discredit them, to harm them, to accuse them of ties to terrorism, both at their offices in Palestine and here in the United States, mostly driven by groups like the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, who were not happy with the fact that they were doing good work, that they had a great reputation, that they were honest. And then by 2008, 2009, they went through one civil trial, two criminal trials, and are now in federal prison serving very long prison terms. Two of them are in for 65 years, one for 20 years, and two of them for 15 years. And it's such a miscarriage of justice that it's sometimes hard to find the words to describe.
I participated along with Ramsey Clark and Graylin Hagler, Mara Verheiden-Hilliard, and Mahdi Bray, and a number of other people in fundraising efforts for these defendants before they were sent to prison. I went to a meeting in Dallas, huge meeting, a lot of support from the community, especially from the Muslim community. The media down there was extremely hostile, characterizing these individuals as terrorists. What's the actual charge, and why do you assert that it's wrong, that they're not terrorists? What is the government saying, and why is it not true?
Well, between the time that they were shut down after 9/11 and the time that they were convicted, so within about 8 years, the government tried to show that they had been that they had provided financial support to Hamas. But having looked at their records and having looked at their accounting and having looked at everything they've done, it was absolutely clear that they did no such thing. So then the government changed the story slightly and said, well, they may not have been giving the money directly to Hamas, which was designated a terrorist organization here in the United States in 1995, but they were giving money to charity, local charity committees in Palestine called Zakat committees, and they are controlled by Hamas. Now, the problem with that argument is that the U.S. government works with those Zakat committees. The Red Cross works with them. The United Nations works with them. USAID gave the money and so forth. Everybody that works in charity in Palestine works with these committees because they're well-organized, they're honest, they do a good job, and they know the lay of the land. So the government brought in two anonymous Israeli intelligence officers who were supposedly experts in the field, and they too said, no, these committees are absolutely controlled by Hamas. Now, the government has a list of designated terrorist organizations. None of these committees were ever designated. So the government said, well, you don't need to designate every subgroup. It's enough that we designated Hamas, and they are part of Hamas. So then the defense team showed that the government does designate subgroups because they did designate certain subgroups and even certain individuals as terrorists, as designated terrorists, even though they were already connected to Hamas. Now, then they went through not only the list of these committees, but their board members and people who were affiliated and working with them. And none of them were working with Hamas. None of them were controlled by Hamas. None of them had anything to do with Hamas. So the government insisted that they were part of Hamas, even though all the evidence showed that they had nothing to do with Hamas. And in the end, what one of the lawyers said to me was, the only place in the world where the Zakat committees are considered part of Hamas was in the courtroom in the Northern District of Texas. That is the only place, because the rest of the world works with them and has been working with them and knows them to be you know, just good apolitical organizations.
And this trial was no slam dunk. In fact, the first trial resulted in a mistrial. And besides the mistrial, the jury found that the defendants were not guilty of a wide variety of crimes. They were charged with dozens and dozens of felonies.
True.
And the jury found that they had not committed those crimes and then deadlocked on others. The government then refiled charges, brought in these two anonymous Israeli sources that you talked about, and pushed the case through.
Yeah.
As a result, as you mentioned, Miko, a few minutes ago, we're talking about draconian sentences here of 65 years in at least two of the cases. Can you talk about whether there's any kind of appeal underway or anything that defense attorneys are able to do to try to revisit this case? Are there any grounds for appeal?
Well, I'll backtrack just a little bit. At the end of the first trial, not only was there a hung jury, but one of them, one of the defendants, Mufid Abdulkader, was found not guilty on all charges. They were charged, they had 32 charges in the first trial. And the judge read not guilty 32 times. When they polled the jury, one at a time, for some reason that is not, has not been explained clearly to anyone, one of the jurors woke up and said, no, I made a mistake, I didn't mean it. At which point the judge said, fine, mistrial on him too. He is now serving 20 years in federal prison. So this is so outrageous that it's beyond, you know, like I said, sometimes you can't find the words to describe this. Now, when the second trial ended in convictions, so they came back at the second trial and they realigned, they changed the charges a little bit. They made them simpler. Second trial ends with all convictions.
On every count that was charged.
On every count that was charged, yes. And they didn't charge everybody with the same counts like they did the first time.
Right.
They rearranged it to make it easier for
the
jury to convict.
Right, they threw in some tax charges and conspiracies and things like that.
Right. And so Ghassan Elashi and Shukri Abubakar, who were the main people within the group, the most connected to the Hoyland Foundation, to the organization, each got 65 years, and they had 30 or over 30 charges. The others only had 3 charges. They came out with all convictions. Now, there were differences, clear differences between what the first judge allowed in the first trial and what the second judge allowed in the second trial. So they went to appeal, and the appellate court came back and says, those things were wrong. They should not have been allowed. The second judge should not have allowed those pieces of evidence and those particular witnesses to participate. They should not have allowed them. They had no room in that courtroom. However, they said, these mistakes were harmless.
They always say that.
So they came back in front of the full circuit, full court, and they said, wait a minute. How can you say it was harmless? They were convicted. And they just upheld the convictions. And then the Supreme Court wouldn't hear it.
Right.
Habeas brief, of course, didn't
2012.
Work. Yeah, that wasn't going to work either. I think that was pretty clear to everybody that that wasn't going to work. And there was an attempt to get President Obama to deport them.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a pretty serious campaign to get other governments to accept them and give them citizenship. And then they agreed. But President Obama, you know, from what's understood, you know, wouldn't do it. Wouldn't even look at the file.
You know, we should remind our listeners, too, that in the federal system, there is no probation. There's no parole. There's no early release. You get good behavior time of 13.5%, not 15 as the law calls for, because there's a difference in the calculation between what Congress intended and what the Justice Department actually implemented. So when we're talking about 65-year sentences here, we're talking about essentially the death penalty.
Absolutely. We're talking about life sentence, absolutely. And these guys, you know, these guys are all in their, you know, 60s,
sure,
you know, approaching 70, some of them. So this is such an outrageous injustice that, again, I keep saying it. Sometimes it's hard to find the words, although I had to find quite a few words to write the book to describe it. But that's the reality. We have five men, completely innocent five men, good men, who are in federal prison now.
Miko Pellet is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker and John Kiriakou. Miko, we only have about 1 minute left. Your book is Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Who's the publisher? When will it come out? Are you available to come and speak in different cities? Because this is obviously a story that needs to get told. It won't be told really through the corporate-owned media. Go ahead.
Yes, the publisher is Just World Books. The book is officially coming out. The official launch is February 6th. And we will be touring. I will be speaking all over the country. I'm happy to, if anybody wants to approach me or approach the publisher, please feel free to do so. We are filling up the calendar as we speak right now to talk about this case.
Check out the book and Miko's website, MikoPeled, that's MikoPeled.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The European Union and the UK have reportedly finally reached an agreement on the size of the so-called divorce bill as part of negotiations over the exit of the country from the European Union. Is Brexit back on track, or is the hard part just beginning? We're joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, welcome back to the show.
Delighted to be here.
One of the questions I have for you is, we're so focused on the details of the divorce bill. One of the things that we haven't heard too much about is the possibility of hard borders again. There's going to have to be some sort of a border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland once Brexit takes effect. Is there a chance that a hard border is going to return to the UK?
Well, if you listen to what people are saying in London, there is a very strong chance of it. In fact, certain British ministers have gone on record as saying that the Irish, and I think they mean both the Northern Irish and the Southern Irish, need to be realistic about the situation. Realistic from, of course, the British point of view. The British always like to project whatever they say as being realistic, which implies that these people are moving towards a hard border. I would add that our current Prime Minister, Theresa May, is somebody who is very committed politically to hard borders. And it is problematic to see how a hard border for the UK could be organised if there is a soft border for between Northern and Southern Ireland. However, the political implications of something like that are very great indeed. They would have serious destabilizing consequences throughout Ireland, but of course especially in Northern Ireland, where a lot of the people there actually do not identify with British rule, consider British rule to be illegitimate, and want to see the Republic, the Northern Ireland, united with the Republic of Ireland, which they see as the true government, the true state of Ireland.
Yeah, Alexander, sadly, because the American people may not really understand the hard border, soft border issue, we need to explain that very briefly to them. And I'm also looking at The Guardian. I'm going to read a paragraph to you from it and have you comment again after explaining the hard border, soft border. Ireland, which is looking for a written commitment that there will be no return to a hard border with Northern Ireland, has threatened to veto progress if Britain does not come up with a satisfactory and concrete offer this weekend. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, the thing to understand is that as a member of the European Union, there is complete mobility of movement for all citizens of the European Union within the European Union. Britain is currently a member of the European Union. Ireland is a member of the European Union. So people from Britain and Ireland can move between each other's countries with minimal difficulties. There are not strict border controls. Now, Ireland, Southern Ireland, used to be, before 1922, a part of the United Kingdom. The Irish people rebelled against the British and, after a bitter war, successfully set up an independent state in the south of Ireland. Part of the island of Ireland, however, remained under British rule, and some of the people there continue to identify with Britain, and others continue to identify with the whole of Ireland. So this is a politically fraught situation in Northern Ireland, where there has been a long history of military conflict between the two peoples there and between the British government and those people in Northern Ireland who support union with the South. What happened was that because it became so easy for people to move between these two parts of Ireland, that problem became less. What the Irish government is concerned about is that if there is going to be a hard border again, restricting movement, that will bring back the division of Ireland, which so many people in Ireland have resisted, and that will restart the conflict in Northern Ireland and could lead to violence again there, and not just in Northern Ireland, but throughout Ireland. And what the Irish are saying is this is simply impossible, and unless this situation is resolved, given the risks of destabilization for the whole of Ireland, we're going to block it. We're going to block Brexit.
Alexander, I've got a question for you about the finances of this whole thing. When Theresa May opened the UK's checkbook this week, she put 40 billion euros on the table. At least that's what the press is reporting. 40 billion euros as a starting point.
Meaning 40 billion that Britain would pay.
Britain is going to pay to the EU as part of the so-called divorce. Correct. Nick McPherson, who's the former head of the Treasury in the UK, went to Twitter and said, this is not a negotiation. It's a drive-by shooting. In the meantime, everybody from Boris Johnson to David Davis, who's the Brexit secretary, seem to have come to the conclusion that this is going to cost the UK a lot of money, far more than conservative politicians have told British citizens. Do you think that's the case? Is this going to be so much more expensive that it might begin to change? It's too late, but it might begin to change public opinion?
Well, I think an awful lot of people in Britain are going to be very angry, including an awful lot of people who not only voted for Brexit, but who believe in Brexit. First of all, they were not told during the referendum. They were given no indication that anything like this was going to happen and that Britain was going to have to pay through the nose to leave the European Union. And they will be asking why they weren't told that. They will also be asking why Britain has negotiated itself so badly that it finds itself in a position where it is actually being asked to pay so much and is agreeing to pay so much. This at a time when Britain has experienced a very long period of budgetary austerity, when the health service is in a very poor state, when lots of social spending is very low. So a lot of people are going to be very angry. And they're obviously going to start pointing fingers at the British government, which has clearly mismanaged this process, both by not being frank with the British people about it, probably because it didn't understand it properly itself.
That's interesting. I think that's important. I think even the people who were campaigning for Brexit, if I'm not mistaken, Alexander, they were basically messaging this. Hey, we Britain, as part of our share of the EU national budget, we pay something like 12 billion euros a year or some number like that. And if we're not part of the EU, then we can use that money for the NHS, the National Health Service.
That's exactly what
and
they
so
said.
And so instead of giving our money to these bureaucrats in Brussels for a faraway goods and services, we keep it at home. But then they didn't know that there would be a punishment because as a condition for leaving the EU, the British have to pay a certain number because they're partly helping to dismember the EU. And that's $40 billion. People weren't given this information at all. It sort of shows the danger of government by popular referendum, too, because how can the masses of people without that kind of information available to them in an emotional issue, how can they make a sound decision?
Well, indeed, they weren't able to make an informed decision because, frankly, coming back to our discussion, I'm not convinced that the people involved in the referendum on the government's side were informed about this themselves. They hadn't sat down and spoken to their officials and to the lawyers and to the people in the European Union and realized that there was any danger of this happening. And I suspect the reason is because, of course, they didn't expect that the Brexit vote would go the way it did. And many of them didn't want it to go the way they did. They thought it was all about tactical positioning within the Conservative Party. So now they find themselves in a situation they didn't expect. They're not prepared. They were not prepared for, and we see the price of that.
Just a series of one colossal mistake after another, all unintended consequences. Brexit was created so that the British people could vote no to Brexit, and yet they voted yes by a relatively slim majority, but still a majority. I think Alexander's completely right, John. The British government had no expectation that they would lose. The Labour Party and the Tories expected Brexit to fail.
Right.
There was no preparation for this. We're in uncharted territory.
Yeah. No plan for what happens the next day.
And then you have the British government, the Tories, the Conservatives, I mean, so weakened by a self-inflicted blow here, or blows. It's not one. It's multiple.
In fact, Tory leavers, which is the pro-Brexit faction of the Conservative Party in Parliament, have admitted to the press in the last few days that the whole strategy, the whole policy is off the rails and that they're just winging this day to day.
Yeah.
And that's probably why it's the cost of it has been so shocking to the British people.
And the big losers ultimately, because of the way this has gone down, will be the people. I mean, that's who yes. ultimately always pays the price for this. Go ahead, Alexander. We have about 90 seconds left.
We're already looking at huge amounts of money that are going to be paid. I mean, 40 billion euros is a huge amount of money. It's an astronomical amount of money on top of the austerity that has already happened. And the problem is that not only did the British government not have a plan before the Brexit referendum took place, it hasn't really got a plan now. We've never really been told, right, this is what Britain needs to do to get itself ready for life outside the European Union. There's no strategy, and because there's no strategy to do that, there's no real negotiating strategy to deal with the Europeans either. A living from day to day, tactical positioning, trying to win the odd vote in the House of Commons, trying to keep Theresa May in office, balancing the various ministers in the cabinet, that is the priority at the moment. And it is exactly as you say, it is the British people who are paying the price.
You know, as an EU citizen, which I proudly have been for the last, 7 or 8 years, I wonder what this is going to do for me. I love the UK. I enjoy traveling there. I spent the happiest year of my life there when I was in college. But I fear that it's not the place that I once knew, and I fear that it's going to be tough for me, even with an EU passport, to get into the UK again.
I think an awful lot is going to depend on how the British people react to the evolution of events. Certainly, the Brexit referendum and the whole Brexit process has highlighted a very ugly side in British politics. But there are countervailing forces. We see this with the change in the Labour Party, the rise of Jeremy Corbyn, all sorts of growth of alternative media, which is also starting here, and the way that the shape that is taking, which is different from that in the US, I would say. So I think that it could very well turn out in the end that we might have a Britain that will undergo a profound shock, that will certainly experience many economic difficulties, but which might, at the end of it, come out a wiser place. I hope so. One always has to hope. Why I live here, and for that reason, if only for that reason.
I hope so, too. That's the voice of Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. He's joined us from London. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Loud and Clear, and we will be right back after this message.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Americans continue to be gobsmacked at the pace of sexual harassment allegations coming out of Washington, Hollywood, the media, and now even tech companies. Meanwhile, the New York Times is even keeping a count of how many men are being accused of crimes ranging from misconduct to lewd texts to rape. Joining us here in the studio is Michelle Witte. She is the news editor here at Sputnik, and she joins us to talk about what happens next. Michelle, welcome to the studio.
Hi, thanks.
So what does happen next? This thing seems to have taken on a life of its own. It's, I think, an incredibly positive development for society. In fact, I went out last night with a friend who told me that he's been racking his brains trying to think of whether or not he's been guilty of some of these actions. I think that's a positive for all of us. It's a game changer, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really positive development in terms of the cultural mood, in terms of maybe allowing women to have more frank dialogues with their male coworkers and friends, and allowing them to come forward sooner with any issues that they're having in the workplace. My worry is that, at least from what I'm seeing right now, with the consequences for men seem to still be arbitrary decisions coming down from on high. And I worry that as long as we're relying on the cultural mood to force these people to face consequences, that this isn't going to, it's not going to last. And we're not creating any replicable processes for this to continue when the mood shifts, because we've all seen that the cultural mood can definitely change. And so while it's great to see people finally being called to account for their actions, it's still somebody more powerful than the man below him who's playing sort of judge, jury, and executioner. And I don't really think that is helpful in the long run.
Yeah, I think that's true.
It's very interesting because the people who are being fired, even Harvey Weinstein, who seemed to be the big boss, he's actually an employee, too, of the corporation. They can fire him, and they did. Matt Lauer, he might be making $29 million a year. He might be the guy at NBC, but he can be fired once he becomes a liability. And that liability is determined, I don't think, because of some sort of moral cleansing or sort of moment of enlightenment by the NBC seniors. It's because they realize that it's going to come out. There was a New York Times story coming, and it was going to be bad for business. So yeah, they can fire Matt Lauer.
We've all been through sexual harassment training courses, right? So many corporations, most corporations in America mandate classes like this, but there's a difference between sexually harassing someone by paying unwanted attention to them and calling a staff meeting and then being butt naked when your female employees walk into the room.
Right? Yes. Well, so, see, if there's more training programs like that, then these men would know with a sufficient training, you should keep your clothes on. I guess that's the...
Right, who does things like that? I mean, that in and of itself was shocking to me, that people like Charlie Rose would do, like, does he think that that's going to be attractive somehow?
And it wasn't a secret. I mean, everybody knew what was going on.
No, and I do feel like, I mean, my male friends are also having this moment of introspection, right? I had a friend who was like, yeah, I looked back on my life. It was about a 2-second perusal because I realized this is not in me. And I do feel like, you know, there are people who are socially awkward, and there are people with bad comic timing, and there are people who are bad at reading social cues. But there is a really thick line, I think, between men who are satisfied with contact, sexual or romantic, that is coerced, and those who aren't. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't actually think, which is why, you know, when people try to describe this movement as like an attack on men and that all men should be scared, I think that's nonsense.
That's nonsense.
You know what I mean? It's like we've all had awkward situations in our lives, but we don't have every situation be awkward. We're not constantly trying to talk people into being in a room with us or watching us masturbate.
So many of us have daughters too, and we all have mothers. Would you want someone to treat your daughter this way? Would you want someone to treat your mother or your sister this way? It's a pretty easy question to answer.
But I do think, I mean, I think ultimately a lot of this is about power, right? It's people like Louis C.K. wasn't asking the people who were funding his programs to come into his office and watch him, right? Like people are not, the people doing this are not so far gone that they don't understand who is prey and who isn't prey. And I feel like in order to really catch hold of this mood and make a change that is going to be permanent, we need to look really closely at power, at the people who come to power, at what their power allows them to do, and try to find ways to mitigate that so that they don't hold people's, you know, entire employments and livelihoods in their hands.
Yeah, what we're witnessing is something that is so multi-layered because it's all around us. There's a pervasive problem of this because of power and the impact that power provides some, mostly men, not exclusively, to take advantage of or carry out criminal acts against their employees. Rape seems to be one of those few crimes where, unlike all other crimes where the criminal is demonized, we're trying to find some explanation for his behavior. Like, you don't, when somebody murders, you don't say, why did they murder? You know, but when it comes to sexual abuse or rape or sexual assault, people are like, yeah, we have to go to rehab now. We have to think about what's wrong with this. These are criminal acts, and that's allowable because the people with power are able to get away with it or have been up until now. So that's one layer. And then there's the other layer of accountability and how does it actually take place? What you're talking about, is this just going to be a fad? Is there going to be an institutionalization of consequences so that it's not simply an arbitrary, discretionary act by people who have even more power? And then thirdly is the issue of how do men interact with and treat women generally, which isn't just about power. It's also about the objectification of women, the sexualization of women. And that's also a big part of the discussion, which may be a secondary piece that comes out. But also, if according to your discussions with your friend and John's discussions with his friend, also a very big issue.
To me, also, the question that hasn't really been answered is, what do you, like, what happens with these people that we've identified as offenders? You know, like someone like Matt Lauer or Harvey Weinstein or whoever, they're going to slink away to their mansions and still be incredibly wealthy people, right, with millions of dollars. And, you know, we have legal processes to deal with rape. But what do you do with a man who's accused of sexual assault or sorry, of harassment in the workplace, who loses his job? Like, how do we as a society create a sort of process of retribution and justice for this? And does it serve us to just have people be shunned and out of work for their entire, like, I don't think that does serve us as a society for any crime to not ever have any kind of process of rehabilitation. And this is another thing that I kind of want to see happen in this wave, is an idea of like, well, what happens? What do we, you know, do we have like a pasture where we put men who can't be allowed to work with women or something? I don't know, but I think it's a question that needs to be answered, because again, right now it just seems arbitrary. And when you just have arbitrary acts coming down, all you do is create fear, and nobody behaves well in an atmosphere of fear, you know?
One of the things that we talked about earlier, John, in the show, was that in the inauguration of the women's movement of the late 1960s and early 1970s, there was a wave really of empowerment of women, so that the women were forming women's organizations, they were self-acting, they were empowered, and they were challenging their male counterparts. And a lot changed then. It was kind of a cultural revolution of sorts. It became system-wide, I mean, countrywide. It was everywhere. The issue here right now, Michelle, is it possible that we could be entering a new wave, a pivotal moment, not just a fad that will go away, but where women become self-acting or are self-acting, banding together, forming women's organizations, insisting on the kind of conversation that you're just talking about that isn't happening but still needs to happen? Because unless women are driving it, it would seem to me, I don't see who will drive it.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a good outcome. But I also feel like in order to do that, you have to constantly be in conversation with men. You know, like a bunch of women getting together in a room talking about this is just isolating yourself from the issue. And I don't, you know, like, I like men. Most of my friends are probably men. So I feel like this conversation has to continue and be frank and be honest, but it can't, I don't think it should become essentialist. And I don't think it it can be really fruitful in a totally segregated organization.
Right. It has to become the national conversation.
Yeah. And we have to be more willing to talk to each other about it. And we have to be more willing to say, like, here's a line for me. You crossed it. Please don't do it again. Or to say, look, this person is doing something wrong. I recognize it as wrong. Society's not telling me at such volume anymore that I'm being ridiculous, and to be able to come to somebody else with that problem. I don't want to sound like I'm victim blaming or putting the responsibility on women here. I hope that didn't come out that way. No. I just mean, like, I hope that it enables that kind of dialogue, right?
And of course, for many men who thought they were acting with impunity, they're on notice right now, I would say. So that's
true.
That would have a big, big impact on what comes next. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We'll be back on Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear. Thank you.